the boy had spoken at the fire comprised their collective word hoard. The sisters began breaking open the husk bundles, and steam rose from them in the cool air. When they were done, they had 6 loaves of dark bread, each shaped to depict a big-headed homunculus, even down to the detail of swollen organs rising up along the bellies of the figures. The girls cast the husks into the fire, and they flared up and burned away in a breath. "We knowed you'd come," Lila said. The two sisters gave a loaf to each of the boys. They tore at them and thrust pieces as big as their fists into their mouths. When they were done eating, they began again treading the faint pathways they had worn in the dirt. Inman watched them, trying to make out what forms they were shaping with their walking. Here might be a sign he ought not miss. But after a time he gave up. He could make no sense of the marks on the ground. The two girls took the remaining 3 loaves and went into the house. Lila came and stood next to Inman. She put a hand onto his shoulder and said, "Big man like you." He could not see what response was called for here. Finally, he took off his haversack with his money and the lamats in it and set it on the ground at his feet. The night had risen up to all but full dark now, and he could see off on a hillside that there seemed to be a yellow light moving wavery and inconclusive through the trees, one moment haloed and diffuse, the next a hard bright point. So odd did the light appear that Inman wondered if it emanated from no outside source, but was an effect of some misfunction in his thinking. "What is that?" Inman said. Lila followed the light a moment and said, "That's nothing. It's little tonight. Sometimes it's big as an extra moon. What it is, up on that hill one time when I was a girl, Junior killed a man and his dog, cleaved off their 2 heads with a fro and set them each by each up on a hickory stump. We all went and looked. The man's face was turned almost nigger black, and he had a funny look in its eyes. Ever since then, some nights, there's that light moving across the hill. You could go up there right now and not see a thing, but maybe something rub up against you like an old dry heifer hide." "Why did he kill the man?" Inman asked. "He never said. He's got a temper on him, and he's quick to strike out. He shot his own mama dead. The way he tells it, she had her apron wrapped about her, and he took her for a swan." "I've not noticed a surplus of swans in this country," Inman said. "They's few." The light on the hill had sharpened off to blue and picked up speed, flickering among the trees, and then it was gone. "What do you think that light is?" Inman said. "God Almighty Himself says clear as day in the Bible that the dead don't have an idea in their heads. Every thought flies from them, so it's not that headless man. I believe it's like people say, sometimes specter dogs carry lanterns on their heads. But I could be wrong. The old folks say there used to be a sight more ghosts than now." Lila looked at him a fair length of time. She rubbed her hand on his forearm. "I believe you traveling under a black flag," she said. "I'm under no colors," he said. One of the sisters came to the back stoop and said, "Come eat." Inman carried the haversack to the porch, and Lila reached and took the straps of his pack over his shoulders and down his arms and set it beside the sack. Inman looked down at it and thought, that would be a mistake, but he could not order his thoughts farther. As Lila and her sister turned to walk into the house, he took the haversack and thrust it elbow deep into a space between sticks of cordwood stacked on the porch. He followed the girls into the house, which now seemed unaccountably larger than it had earlier. They led him down a ramp-like hallway of unpainted plank walls, and he felt that his feet were about to slide out from under him. In the dark, the place seemed a vast warren, cut up mazy into many tiny rooms with doors on each wall. The rooms fed into each other in ways that defied logic, but eventually Inman and Lila made their way into the canted main room, where places were set at the bumpered table. Veezy slept on like the dead in the chimney corner. A lamp was smoking on the table, and its feeble light moved across the surfaces of wall and floor and tablecloth like shadows on the stones of a creek bottom. Lila sat Inman at the head of the table and tied a check napkin around his neck. A loaf from the ashes was wrapped in another napkin in the center of the table. One of the sisters brought a platter from the hearth, atop it a massive joint of meat swimming in lucent grease. Inman could not say just what creature it came from. It seemed too big for hog, but too pale for cow. It was a ball and socket arrangement, clods of meat at either bone end. White threads of tendon and ligament wove through the meat. The girl set the platter in front of him, chalking it level with the bowl of an upturned cooking spoon. There was only a rust-spotted knife at his place. He picked it up and looked at Lila. "We've nary meat fork," she said. Inman gripped the bone with his left hand and carved, but never made scarce a mark on the pith of the joint. All three girls now had gathered about the table to gauge its progress. Together they cast a breedy scent like that rising from dank beds of galax, and it overpowered even the reek of the strange meat. Lila eased over next to Inman and rubbed the soft of her belly against his shoulder, and then she shifted up on the balls of her feet, and he could feel the bewhiskered notch of her leg scratch at his skin through the thin dress. "You a fine-looking thing," she said. "Bet you draw the women like dog hair draws lightning." One of the sisters gazed at Inman and said, "I wish he'd hug me till I grunt." Lila said, "This is mine. All that's left for you is just to look at him, and then to go to wishing in one hand and shitting in the other and see which one gets full first." Inman felt a kind of weary numbness. He was still sawing on the joint, but his arms felt heavy. The burning wick of the lantern seemed to be casting out strange rays into the dim of the room. Inman thought back on the jug and wondered what fashion of drunk he was. Lila took his greasy left hand from its grip on the bone and ran it up under her skirt and rested it high on her thigh so that he could feel that she had on no drawers. "Get on out," she said to the sisters, and they walked to the hall. One of them turned at the door and said, "You just like the preacher says, your church founded on Peter." Lila shoved the meat platter to the high end of the table with a thumb, knocking it off the spoon and slopping out gray gravy, which ran downhill and dripped from the table end. Lila shifted and rolled until she was sitting on the table before Inman, her legs astraddle him, her bare feet resting on the arms of his chair. She pulled her skirt back to a bunch at her waist and leaned back on her elbows and said, "How about that? What does that favor?" Not a thing other than itself, Inman thought, but his mind would not shape words, for he felt as inert as one behexed. His glossy handprint remained on her pale thigh, and beyond that the gaping aperture. It seemed extraordinarily fascinating, though it was but a mere slot in flesh. "Get you some," she said, and she shrugged her shoulders out of the dress top, and breasts came spilling out, pale nipples as big around as the mouth of a pint jar. Lila leaned forward and pulled Inman's head into the rift between her breasts. At that moment the door burst open, and Junior stood with a smoking lantern in one hand and the 10-gauge in the other. "The hell's going on?" he said. Inman sat back in his chair and watched as Junior leveled the shotgun at him and cocked the pointy hammer that looked as long as a mule's ear. The raw hole at the end of the short barrel was black and enormous. It would throw a shot pattern covering most of the wall. Lila rolled off the table and began yanking in various directions at her dress until she was largely covered again. This would be one sorry shithole to die in, Inman thought. There was a long pause, and Junior stood sucking on an eye tooth and studying deep on something, and then he said, "What you about to learn is, there ain't no balm in Gilead." Inman sat at the table looking at the board of Junior's shotgun and thought, there would be a thing to do here, a right action to take. But he could not arrive at it. He felt fixed as stone. His hands lay in front of him on the tablecloth, and he stared at them and thought uselessly, "They're starting to look like my father's, though not long ago they didn't." Junior said, "The only way I can reason this out to my satisfaction is that we've got a marrying coming, that or a killing one." Lila said, "Goody." "Wait," Inman said. "Wait," Junior said, "it's too late to wait." He looked over to where Veezy lay asleep in the chimney corner. "Go wake him up," he said to Lila. "Wait," Inman said again, but he could not formulate a sentence beyond that point. His thoughts would not serve his purpose. They refused to achieve order or proportion, and he wondered again what had been in the jug by the yard fire. Lila went and bent over Veezy and shook him. He awoke with breasts in his face, grinning as if he had passed on to a new world, until he saw the shotgun bore. "Now you go get them other ones," Junior said to Lila. He walked over to her and slapped her hard across the face. She put a hand to the rising red mark and left the room. "There's one other thing," Junior said to Inman. "Get up." Inman stood, but he felt that he frabbled on his feet. Junior moved around, keeping Inman covered, and took Veezy by the coat collar and stood him up and walked him slowly across the room. Veezy was yanked up onto the balls of his feet, so he walked like a man sneaking up on something. When he had them paired, Junior prodded Inman in the ass with the jagged shotgun barrel. "Take a look out yonder at what I fetched," Junior said. Inman moved as one would underwater, effortfully and slow, out to the front porch. Up at the road he could see faint movement in the dark, shapes and masses only. He heard the expelled breath of a horse, a man's cough, the tick of a hoof on stone. A light was struck and a lantern flared, then another, and yet one more, until, in the glaring yellowy light, Inman could make out a band of home guard. Behind them, afoot, a tangle of men shackled and downcast, shading off into the murk. "You're not the first one I've snared in here," Junior said to Inman. "I get $5 a head for every outlier I turn in." One of the horsemen called out, "We going or what?" But an hour later, they had still not gone. They had tied Inman and Veazey onto a string of prisoners and shoved them all against the wall of the smokehouse. None of the tied men had said a word. They moved to the wall with barely more animation than a parade of cadavers, all shuffle-footed and vague, blank-eyed, so tired from the manner of their recent living as soldier, fugitive, captive, that they leaned back and immediately fell open-mouthed sleep, without twitch or snort. Inman and Veazey, though, sat wakeful as the night progressed. At intervals they wrenched against the windings of rope at their hands, hoping for any sign of give. The guard built up the fire until it stood as high as the eaves of the house and threw glare and shade against the walls of the buildings. The light of it blanked out the true stars, and sparks flew up in a column, and then peered into the dark. A vision which suggested to Inman that the stars had drawn together in Congress and agreed to flee, to shed light on some more cordial world. Off on the hillside, the beacon of the ghost dog shone orange as a pumpkin and skittered about among the trees. Inman turned and stared at the fire. Dark figures passed back and forth before it, and after a time one of the guards brought fiddle, winked at the string, quizzed the instrument for tin. Satisfied, he pulled on the bow and struck up a simple droning figure of notes, which soon revealed itself to be circular in logic. The pattern came around again and again at close intervals, and seemed equally suited to dancing or, if repeated long enough, to throwing a man into a daze. The guardsman, silhouetted against the fire, pitched back from the hips and pulled at the contents of various jugs and stoups. Then they danced about the fire, and sometimes they could be seen paired up with Lila, or one of the sisters, rubbing in various shadowy tableaus of rut. "There's not a great variance between this place and a damn Jenny barn," Veazey said, "other than that they've not charged anybody anything yet." Those men not immediately occupied with Lila or the sisters danced alone. They went round and round, jerking in a buck and wing, bent at the waist, stepping with high knees, their faces alternately staring down at their feet on the ground and bending back to speculate on the blanked heavens. Now and again, possessed by the music, one would squeal out as if wounded. They danced until they all had to stop and blow, and then Junior, apparently far gone in drink, tried to organize a wedding between Inman and Lila. "I went in the house and that tall one was just getting into short rows with Lila," Junior said. "We ought to wed them." "You're not no preacher," the guard captain said. "That little shaved-off one is," Junior said, looking at Veazey. "God damn," the captain said, "he don't much look like it." "Will you witness?" Junior said. "If that'll get us on the road," the man said. They got Inman and Veazey from the smokehouse and untied them and walked them at gunpoint to the fire. The three girls stood waiting, the pair of dark-headed boys with them, the guard off to the side spectating, their shadows jittery and huge against the walls of the house. "Get over there," Junior said. Inman took a step toward Lila, but then a thought that had been trying to come into his mind finally arrived. He said, "But she's already married." "By the law she is." "Not in my mind or God's eyes," Junior said. "Get on over." Inman went will-less to stand alongside Lila. "Oh, boy," she said. Her hair was newly bound up in a snood-like wad at her neck. Her cheeks had been daubed with face paint, but under it the left side of her face was still flushed with the mark of Junior's hand. She held clutched against her belly a bunch of goldenrod and ironweed pulled from the fence row of the cornfield. She described little delighted circles in the dirt with her toes. Junior and Veazey stood to the side, the shotgun pressed to the base of Veazey's spine. "I'll say what needs to be said, and you just say, uh-huh," Junior said to Veazey. Junior untied the string at his chin and removed his hat and set it on the ground at his feet. His head was covered with a faint smear of coarse hair spread thin across his pate, a stand of hair more suited to be growing on a man's ass. He struck a formal pose with the shotgun cradled in his arms and commenced a rock-voiced prothalamian. It vaguely took the form of song, modal and dark, and the dire jig of its tune grated on the ear. The theme of its lyric, the best Inman could decipher it, was death and its inevitability and the unpleasant consequences of life. The pair of boy children tapped their feet as if they knew the main rhythm of the song and approved of it. When he was done singing, Junior began the talking portion of the ceremony. The words bound and death and sickness were featured prominently. Inman looked off to the hillside, and the ghost light was moving again through the trees. Inman wished it would just come on and carry him away. When the wedding was over, Lila threw the flowers into the fire and hugged Inman tight, pressed one full thigh up between his legs. She looked him in the eye and said, "Bye-bye." One of the home guards stepped behind him and clapped a Colt's pistol to his temple and said, "Figure that. 1 minute a bride, and the next, if I pull this trigger, she'll put a smile on her face and scoop her husband's horns off the ground into a napkin." "I do not understand you people," Inman said, and they retied him and Vizi to the string of men and marched them off down the road east. For several days, Inman walked tied at the wrists to the end of a long rope with 15 other men, so that they went strung together like tailed colts. Vizi was tied directly before Inman, and he slogged along with his head down, stunned at his misfortune. When the line started or stopped, he was yanked forward, and his bound hands flew up before his face like a man in sudden need of prayer. Some of the men farther up the line were old graybeards, others little more than boys, all of them accused of being deserters or sympathizers. Most of them were country people in homespun. Inman gathered they were all prison-bound, that or to be sent back fighting. Some men periodically called out to the guard, shouting excuses and declaring to be altogether other men from what they were accused of being. Innocence was their claim. Others muttered out threats, saying were their hands not tied, and had they an axe, they would cleave the guardsmen down from crown to groin, dividing them into equal bleeding parts onto which they would piss before walking away to find home. Others sobbed and begged to be freed, calling upon some imagined force of kindness resident in men's hearts to advance their interests. Like the vast bulk of people, the captives would pass away from the earth without hardly making any mark more lasting than plowing a furrow. You could bury them and knife their names onto an oak plank and stand it up in the dirt, and not one thing, not their acts of meanness or kindness or cowardice or courage, not their fears or hopes, not the features of their faces, would be remembered, even as long as it would take the gouged characters in the plank to weather away. They walked, therefore, bent, as if bearing the burden of lives lived beyond recollection. Inman hated being sutured up to the others, hated going unarmed, hated most moving retrograde to his desires. Every step east he trod was bitter as backsliding. The miles passed, and hope of home began fleeing from him. When the sun rose full in his face, he spit at it, having no other way of striking out. The prisoners walked all that day, and for several days following, with hardly a word spoken among them. To entertain himself one afternoon, a guardsman rode down the line, and with the barrel to his shotgun, knocked every man's hat onto the ground, and any man who bent to pick up his hat was beat with the stock end of the gun. They walked on, leaving 15 black hats lying in the road as spoor of their passage. For food they were given nothing, and for drink they had but what water they could bend and scoop a cupped hand of whenever the road forded a creek. The old men of the party grew especially weak from such short rations, and when they could no longer walk, even when prodded by rifle barrels, they were fed a gruel made of buttermilk with old cornbread crumbled up in it. When their heads cleared, they marched on. The men had got in such a scrape, each of them in the usual way, one damn event treading on the heels of another, until they were in a place they never expected to be and could see no way clear of. Inman's thoughts turned constantly on such matters. And other than to be set free, there was nothing he longed for more than to see Junior's blood running. Some days the guards drove the prisoners all day and they slept at night. Some days they would sleep and arise at sundown and set out walking and keep at it all night. But after each march, where they arrived was much of a sameness with where they had been, pine woods so dense at their crowns that the sun would never shine on the ground. For all the variance in landscape Inman could see, he might have been moving through the dark at about the strange and sluggish pace of a man in a dream who runs away from what he fears, but try as he might, makes little headway against it. And, too, he hurt from the hard traveling. He felt weak and dizzy, hungry as well. The wound at his neck throbbed with his heartbeat, and he thought it might break open and start spitting things out, as it had at the hospital. The lens to a field glass, a corkscrew, a bloody little salter. He watched all the westward miles he had accomplished start coming unspooled in a tangle under his feet. After some days of walking, they stopped at nightfall, and the prisoners were left tied without food or water. The guard, as on the previous nights, made no provision for their sleeping, neither giving them blankets nor striking fire. In their exhaustion, the roped men piled up like a dog pack to sleep on the bare red ground. Inman had read books where prisoners in castle keeps scratch marks on sticks or rocks to track the passage of days, but he had not even the means to do that, though he could see how useful it would be, because he had already started to doubt his mental calendar. No further accounting needed to be kept, though, for deep in the night the prisoners were rousted from thin sleep by one of the guards. He shined a lantern in their faces and told them to stand. The other half-dozen guards stood in a loose group. Some of them were smoking pipes, and they held their rifle muskets butt down on the ground. One of them, who acted in the role of leader, said, "We had us a talk, and decided that you pack of shit are just wasting our time." At that, the guard raised their rifles. A captive boy, not much over 12, fell to his knees and commenced crying. An old man, gray-headed, said, "You can't mean to kill us all here." One of the guards lowered his weapon and looked to the leader and said, "I didn't sign on to kill grandpas and little boys." The leader said to him, "Cock back to fire or get down there with them." Inman looked off into the dark pine woods. "The view from my last resting place," he said within himself. Then the firing started with a volley. Men and boys began falling all around. Veazey stepped forward as far as the rope would allow and shouted amid the firing. He said, "It is not too late to put away this meanness." Then he was shot through a number of times. The ball that hit Inman had already passed through Veazey's shoulder, and as a result did not strike with full briskness. It took Inman in the side of the head at his hairline and ran along his skull between hide and bone, routing a shallow groove there as it passed. It exited behind his ear. He fell as if struck by a lathing hatchet, but consciousness did not leave him entirely. He could not move, not so much as to blink an eye, nor did he wish to. The world moved on about him, and he observed it, though he felt not a part of it. It seemed to scorn understanding. People died all around him and fell all bound together. When the firing was done, the guard stood as if unclear as to what the next step might be. One of them seemed taken by some fit or spell, and he danced about and sang Cotton Eye Joe and capered until another man hit him at the base of his spine with the stock of his musket. Finally, one said, "We'd best get them underground." They went about the job poorly, just digging out a shallow bed and strewing the men in and covering them over with dirt about to the depth that one would plant potatoes. When done, they mounted up and rode away. Inman had fallen with his face in the crook of his arm, and he had breathing space, though the covering of dirt over him was so thin and loose that he might have lain there and starved before he smothered. He rested, drifting in and out of muddled wakefulness. The smell of the dirt pulled at him and drew him down, and he could not find the force to raise himself from it. Dying there seemed easier than not. But before the dawn of day, feral hogs descended from the woods, drawn by the tang in the air. They plowed at the ground with their snouts and dug out arms and feet and heads, and soon Inman found himself uprooted, staring eye to eye, forlorn and hostile and baffled, into the long face of a great tushed boar. "Yah," Inman said. The boar shied off a few feet and stopped and looked back at him, dumbfounded, his little eyes blinking. Inman prized his length out of the ground. To rise and bloom again, that became his wish. When Inman worked his way upright once more, the boar lost interest and went back to grubbing at the ground. Inman cast back his head to the sky and found it did not look right. There were stars in it, but he could not reason out even one known constellation in the moonless sky. It looked as if someone had taken a stick and stirred it up so that no sense remained, just a smattering of light cast patternless on the general dark. As head wounds will do, his had bled all out of proportion to its actual direness. Blood covered his face and dirt had gummed to it, so that his visage was ochre in color and appeared like a clay sculpture illustrating some earlier phase of mankind when facial features were yet provisional. He found the two holes in his scalp and probed them with his fingers, and found them numb and beginning to clot shut. He wiped at himself to little effect with the tail of his shirt. He commenced pulling on the rope at his hands, bent his back to it, and in a minute Veezy emerged from the ground like a big hooked bass pulled up from a muddy lake. Veezy's face was locked in an expression of numb bewilderment. His eyes were open, and Dirk clung to the wet of them. Looking on him, Inman could find no great sorrow at his death, but neither could he find this an example of justice working its way around to show proof that the wrong a man does flies back at him. Inman had seen so much death it had come to seem a random thing entirely. He could not even make a start at reckoning up how many deaths he had witnessed of late. It would number, no doubt, in the thousands, accomplished in every custom you could imagine, and some you couldn't come up with if you thought at it for days. He had grown used to seeing death, walking among the dead, sleeping among them, numbering himself calmly as among the near-dead, that it seemed no longer dark and mysterious. He feared his heart had been touched by the fire so often he might never make a civilian again. Inman cast about until he came up with a sharp stone, and he sat until sunrise rubbing his bound wrists against it. When he finally freed himself, he looked again at Veezy. One eyelid now drooped near closed. Inman wished to commit some kind gesture toward him, but lacking even a shovel for burial, all he could think to do was roll Veezy over, face down. Inman put the dawn to his back and set out walking west. All that morning he felt stunned and wrenched. His head ached in accordance with the beat of his pulse, and felt as if his skull was about to fall into a great number of pieces at his feet. From a fence row he gathered a wad of the feathery leaves of yarrow and tied it to his head with the stripped stem of the plant. The power of yarrow is to draw out pain, which to an extent it did. The leaves waggled in time with his tired walk, and he spent the morning watching the shadows of them move before him down the road. By noon he stood at a crossroads, his mind cloudy, unable to settle on one of the three choices laid out on the ground before him. He had only sense to rule out the way he had come. He looked to the sky for orientation, but the sun stood straight up. It could fall any which way. He put his hand to the ridged-up skin at his head, felt the crusty blood under his hairline, thinking, "I'll soon be naught but scar." The red Petersburg welt at his neck began to hurt, as if in sympathy with its new brethren. All his upper parts felt like some great raw ulcer. He decided to sit in the pine litter at roadside and wait for some sign or token to mark one of the pathways before him as preferable to the others. After a time, during which he lapsed in and out of wakefulness, he saw a yellow slave coming down the road driving a mismatched team of steers, one red and one white. They dragged a sled loaded with fresh barrels and a great number of small dark melons stacked neat as cordwood. The man caught sight of Inman and wowed up the steers. "They, Lord God Almighty," he said, "you look like a dirt man." He reached into the sled and knocked with his fist at two or three melons before selecting one and tossing it underhand to Inman. Inman cracked it open against the edge of a stone. The ragged meat in the halves was pink and firm and cloven by dark seeds, and he plunged his head down into first one and then the other like a hungry dog. When he arose from them, they were naught but thin hulls, and his beard dripped pink juice onto the dirt of the road. Inman stared down for some time onto the pattern the drops made, to see if it held significance in the direction of augury, for he knew he needed aid, no matter from what strange fount it arose. The drops in the dust, though, offered no ready sign, neither pictograph nor totem, no matter from what angle he viewed them. The invisible world, he declared to himself, had abandoned him as a gypsy soul, to wander singular, without guide or chart, through a broken world composed of little but impediment. Inman quit his study of the ground and looked up and said his thanks for the melon. The yellow man was a wiry fellow, slim in all his parts, but corded with muscle in the neck and the forearms where he had the sleeves of his gray wool shirt turned back to the elbow. His canvas breeches had been made for a taller man, and were rolled up into deep cuffs above his bare feet. "Get on this sled and come with me," he said. Inman rode away, sitting on the tailboard, his back against a bright barrel, fragrant of fresh-split white oak. He tried to sleep, but could not, and he stared down, as in a trance, at the drag trails of the wide ash runners, watching them fall away down the dusty road, paired lines that seemed to offer some lesson as they drew nearer and nearer to each other the more distant they got. He pulled off the Yara headdress and dropped it piece by piece into the space between the runner trails. When the yellow man neared the farm where he was owned, he had Inman crawl into one of the barrels, and then he took him on in and unloaded the sled in the barn hall. He hid Inman in the hay under the loft eaves, and Inman rested there in the fodder for some days, and once again he lost track of the count. He spent the time sleeping and being fed by the slaves on corn pone, fried in lard, sharp greens, roasted chines of pork rich and crackling with charred fat. When his legs felt able to bear weight again, Inman prepared to fare forth once more. His clothes had been boiled clean, and his head was some improved, and covered with an old black hat stained dark about the brow band with slave sweat. There was a half moon in the sky, and Inman stood at the barn door bidding the yellow man farewell. "I need to be going," Inman said. "I've got a little business down this way, and then I've got to get home." "You listen," the yellow man said. "A band of Federals broke out of Salisbury Prison last week, and the roads are running thick with patrols riding day and night looking for them. You try to go through there, they'll sure catch you up, you're not careful. Probably catch you even if you are." "What would be best to do?" Inman asked. "Where are you headed?"
"West," Inman said.
"Well, cut north, go to Wilkes. Take that heading. There's Moravians and Quakers all the way that will help. Hit the bottom of the Blue Ridge and then cut south again, following the foothills, or go on into the mountains and follow the ridges back down to your course. But they say it's cold and rough back in there."
"That's where I'm from," Inman said.
The yellow man gave him cornmeal twisted up in paper and tied with twine, a strip of salt pork, and some pieces of roast pork. Then he worked for some time, scratching out a map in ink on a piece of paper, and when it was done, it was a work of art, all detailed with little houses and odd-shaped barns and crooked trees with faces in their trunks and limbs like arms and hair. A fancy compass rose in one corner, and there were notes and a precise script to say who could be trusted and who could not. Gradually things got vague and far apart, until in the west all was white, but for interlinked arcs the man had drawn to suggest the shapes of mountains. "That's as far as I've been," he said, "just right there to the edge."
"You can read and write?" Inman said.
"Got a crazy man for a master. That law don't mean a thing to him." Inman reached in his pockets for money to give the man. He thought to draw out a generous amount, but he found his pockets empty and remembered that what money he had left was in the haversack hidden in Junior's woodpile.
"I wish I had something to pay you with," Inman said.
"I might not have took it anyway," the man said. Several nights later, Inman stood in front of the slanted house. It sat toad-like down in its swale, and the windows were all black. He softly called the three-legged dog from out its den and offered it a piece of pork bone that he had carried in his pocket wrapped in sycamore leaves. The dog came sniffing soundless. It snatched the bone and then disappeared under the front porch. Inman followed the dog down to the house and circled around to the rear. The big fire was but a cold black pock on the ground. He went to the back porch. His knapsack still lay there in a pile. He looked through it, and everything was there but for Veazey's Colt pistol. He thrust his arm into the wood stack and seized the haversack and felt the butt of the Lamats through the fabric. He drew it forth, and it was like a tonic to feel the weight of the pistol in his hand, the balance, and the sound when he pulled back the hammer. A rind of light shone under the smokehouse door, and Inman went and cracked the door and looked inside. Junior stood rubbing salt on a ham. A bayonet was stabbed into the dirt floor, and its muzzle socket held a taper as neatly as a silver candlestick. The floor of the smokehouse was so packed and greasy that the flame cast glints off it. Junior bent over the ham. He had his hat on, and his face was dark in the shade of its brim. Inman opened the door fully and stood in the light. Junior raised up his face and looked at him, but seemed not to recognize him. Inman stepped to Junior and struck him across the ear with the barrel of the Lamats, and then clubbed at him with the butt until he lay flat on his back. There was no movement out of him, but for the bright flow of blood which ran from his nose and cuts to his head and the corners of his eyes. It gathered and pooled on the black earth of the smokehouse floor. Inman stopped and squatted and rested his forearms on his knees to catch his breath. He twisted the candle out of its socket and felt the roughness of it where roaches had been eating at the tallow. He held the light to Junior's face. What lay before him was indeed a horrid thing, and yet Inman feared that the minds of all men share the same nature, with little true variance.
He blew out the candle and then turned and walked outside. There was a wedge of gray light at the east horizon where the moon was fixing to rise. On the hill, the ghost light was weak, fluttery in its movement. It faded off and vanished, though so slowly that you could not have said exactly when. Inman walked all that night, circling north, through a heavily peopled country, window lights shining everywhere, dogs barking. And the yellow man was right. Horsemen passed over and over in the dark, but Inman could hear them coming in time to step into the bushes. When morning came, there was fog, so not having to worry about a little smoke, he lit a fire in the woods and boiled two strips of salt pork and poured meal into the water and made a mess of corn mush. He laid up all that day in a thicket, sleeping some and fretting some. There were crows in the limbs above him, three of them, and they were harrying a rat snake they had discovered up in the tree. They sat on the limbs above the snake and gabbled at it, and now and again one flew close by and feinted at it with glinting bill. The snake made the customary vicious displays of its kind, erecting itself and hooding out its neck and hissing and striking as if it were deadly. But all its efforts were met with hilarity and ridicule by the crows, and the snake soon departed. The crows stayed on through much of the afternoon, celebrating their victory. Inman watched them any time his eyes were open, observing closely their deportment and method of expression. And when his eyes were closed, he dreamed he lived in a kind of world where, if a man wished it, he could think himself into crow form, so that, though filled with dark error, he still had power either to fly from enemies or laugh them away. Then, after a while of passing time in such wise, Inman watched nightfall, and it seemed to him as if the crows had swelled out to blacken everything.
In Place of the Truth. The morning sky was featureless, a color like that made on paper from a thin wash of lamp black. Ralph stood stopped in the field, head down, blowing. He was harnessed to a sled load of locust fence rails, and they were heavy as a similar amount of stones. He seemed not to care to draw them one pace farther toward the edge of the creek, along which Ruby intended to lay out the snake for a new pasture fence. Ada held the plaited carriage whip, and she popped Ralph's back a time or two with the frizzled end of it, to no effect. "He's a carriage horse," she said to Ruby. Ruby said, "He's a horse." She went to Ralph's head and took his chin in her hand and looked him in the eye. He put back his ears and showed her a rim of white at the tops of his eyeballs. Ruby pressed her lips to the velvet nose of the horse and then backed off an inch and opened her mouth wide and blew out a deep, slow breath into its flanged nostrils. The dispatch sent by such a gesture, she believed, concerned an understanding between them. What it said was that she and Ralph were of like minds on the issue at hand. You settle horses' thinking that way. They took it as a message to let down from their usual state of high nerves. You could calm white-eyed horses with such a companionable breath. Ruby breathed again and then took Ralph by a handful of mane above his withers and pulled. He stepped out, pulling the sled, and when they got to the creek, Ruby loosed him from his harness. She set him to grazing on clover that grew at the edge of the tree shade, and then she and Ada worked at laying out a zagging line of locusts down the creek bank. When they got the time, they would lay three more lapped courses atop the snake to make the fence. Ada had noticed that it was not always Ruby's way to start a job and finish it all at one time. She worked at things as they came up, taking them in order of urgency. If nothing was particularly urgent, Ruby did whatever could be done in the time at hand. Putting down the first row of fence rails was chosen that morning because it could be done in the hour or so before Ruby went off to trade with Esco, apples for cabbages and turnips. For the job of handling the heavy rails, Ada wore a pair of leather work gloves, but they had been made rough-side too, and so when she was done, her fingertips were about as raw as if she had gone bare-handed. She sat on the sled and felt for blisters, and then rubbed her hands in the creek and dried them on her skirt. They led the horse back to the barn and unharnessed him and started to bridle him in preparation for Ruby's trading trip. But Ruby stopped and stood looking at an old trap hanging from a peg on the barn wall. It was sized for beaver and groundhogs and like-bodied animals, something the blacks had left when they pulled out for Texas. Its jaws were nearly fused shut, and it had been there so long that rust streaks stained the siding below it. "That's exactly the thing we need," she said. "Might as well set it before I go." They were concerned over the corn crib. A little bit of corn had been missing each morning for days.
After Ruby noticed the shortage, she had fitted the door with a hasp and lock and worked on the chinking where it had dried up and fallen away. But the next morning she found a new hole gouged out in the fresh mud between the crib logs. It was a space plenty big enough for a hand or a squirrel, and maybe big enough for a small coon or possum or groundhog. She had daubed mud into the hole twice, only to find it open again the next morning. Not much corn was stolen at a time, just barely enough to notice, but if the loss kept on, it would soon amount to something worth worrying about. So Ada and Ruby worked over the trap, scrubbing the rust with a wire brush and greasing its joints with lard. When they were done, Ruby put her foot to it and sprung open the jaws. Then she touched the trip plate with a stick, and the thing snapped shut so hard it jumped off the ground. They carried it to the crib and nestled it in among the corn, just within reach of the hole. Ruby hammered the spike at the end of its chain as deep as it would go into the packed dirt of the floor. In case the pilferage was from man rather than beast, Ada urged wrapping the teeth of the trap with strips of sacking, which Ruby did, judging the padding carefully so as not to err too much in the direction of kindness. When done, Ruby bridled Ralph and slung two big sacks of apples over his withers. She mounted and rode off bareback. And at the road, she stopped and hollered to Ada to make herself useful by putting up a scarecrow in the winter garden. Then she touched her heels to the horse and trotted away. It was with some relief that Ada watched Ruby round the bend. She now had the entire midday stretched before her, with no more required than the pleasant and somewhat childlike task of making a big doll. A band of crows had been working in the winter garden, picking at the young plants in a sort of bored way, but even so, without some discouragement, they would soon pick it clean. One crow had feathers missing from both trailing wing edges, identical square notches. It seemed to be the chief of the crows, and was always the first to fly from field or limb. The rest were but followers. Notchwing was more vocal than the others, and said every kind of crow word there was, from the sound of a dry hinge to the gabble of a duck being killed by a fox. Ada had been tracking its doings for weeks, and Ruby had once got so ill at it that she let off a precious barrel of shot in its direction, though at too great a range to do any good. So Ada took pleasure in imagining that her scarecrow would be a thing that Notchwing would have to include in its thinking. With mixed feelings, she said aloud, "I'm living a life now where I keep account of the doings of particular birds." She went to the house. Upstairs she opened a trunk and took out an old pair of riding breeches and a maroon wool shirt of Monroe's, his beaver hat, and a bright throat scarf. From them she might craft a fine and stylish scarecrow. But as she stood looking down at the folded clothes in her hands, all she could imagine was every day walking out and seeing the effigy of Monroe standing in the field. From the porch at dusk it would be a dark figure watching. Her fear was that it would loom larger and more troubling in her mind than it would in the crow's. Ada put the clothes back in the trunk and went to her room and riffled through drawers and wardrobes, and finally she decided on the mauve dress that she had worn the last night of the party on the Wando River, and she took out a French-made straw hat Monroe had bought her 15 years earlier on their tour of Europe, and now frizzing apart at the brim edge. Ruby, she knew, would object to the dress, not on grounds of sentiment, but because the material could be put to better use. Cut up, it could make pillow covers, quilt tops, antimacassars for chair bags, any number of useful things. Ada, though, decided that if it was silk that was wanted, she had a number of other gowns that could as easily be put into service. This was the one she wanted to see standing in a field through rain and shine. She carried the dress outside and then wired together a root of bean poles as armature and planted it out in the center of the garden, beating it firm into the dirt with a hand sledge. She topped it with a head made by stuffing the end of a worn-out pillowcase with leaves and straw and daubing a grinning face on it with paint she stirred up from chimney soot and lamp oil. She put the dress over the poles and fleshed out the bodice with straw and gave the figure the straw hat for millinery. From the end of one arm she hung a small tin pail with a rust hole in its bottom. She went to the fence row and broke off stems of goldenrod and aster and filled the pail with them. When she was done, Ada backed off and examined her work. The figure stood staring off toward Cold Mountain, as if during a leisurely walk gathering flowers for a table arrangement, she had been struck momentarily still by the beauty of the scene before her. The full skirts of the lavender dress swayed in the breeze, and all Ada could think was that after a year of weather, it would become bleached to the color of an old shuck. Ada herself wore a fading print dress and a straw bonnet. She wondered if an observer standing off on Jonas Ridge and looking down into the cove would choose right if asked to pick the scarecrow from the two figures standing in the field. She washed her hands at the basin on the kitchen porch and fixed herself a dinner of a few umber shavings from Esco's ham, cold biscuits left from breakfast, and a wedge of baked pumpkin from supper the evening before. She took her journal and her plate and went to the table under the pear tree. When she was done eating, she paged through the journal, past the sketch of the heron, studies of dogwood berries, clusters of sumac fruit, a pair of water striders, until she reached the first blank page, and on it she sketched the scarecrow, and above it the notched wings of the crow. She wrote down the date, and an approximation of the time, and then the current phase of the moon. At the bottom of the page she put down the names of the flowers in the scarecrow's bucket, and in an unused corner of the page she sketched a detail of aster blossom. Shortly after Ada was done, Ruby came walking up the road. She led the horse, six lumpy sacks of cabbages paired up and slung across its back. That was two sacks more than was fair, but Ruby had not been so proud as to deny Esco the impulse toward generosity. Ada went to the road. Ruby walked to her and stopped and reached in a skirt pocket and took out a letter. "Here you go," she said. "I stopped at the mill." In her tone was the conviction that any message conveyed other than by voice, face to face, was likely to be unwelcome. The letter was creased and wrinkled, dirty as an old work glove. It had been wet at some point in its journey, and had dried, puckered, and stained. It lacked return address, but Ada knew the hand in which her own name was written. She pocketed the letter, not wanting to read it under Ruby's scrutiny. Together they unloaded the sacks beside the smokehouse, and while Ruby put the horse away, Ada went to the kitchen and made another plate to like of her own dinner. Then Ruby ate, talking all the while of cabbages and the many things they would make from them, which to Ada sounded few indeed. Kraut, fried cabbage, boiled cabbage, stuffed cabbage, slaw. When Ruby had eaten, they went to the sacks. One they held back for making into sauerkraut when the signs came around right for it again. Do it otherwise, and it might rot in the crocks. The rest they buried for the winter. It was to Ada an odd and troubling job, digging the grave-like trench behind the smokehouse, and lining it with straw, and heaping the pale heads in, and covering them with more straw and then dirt. When they were done mounding up the dirt, Ruby marked the place with a plank, beating at it with the heel of her shovel until it stood like a tombstone. "There," Ruby said. "That might save us having to scratch around in the snow come January." All Ada could think was how grim it would be on some cloudy midwinter afternoon, wind blowing, bare trees heaving, the ground covered in a gray crust of old snow, to come out and dig into that barra pit for a mere cabbage. Late that afternoon they sat on the stone steps, Ada behind Ruby and a riser above her. Ruby leaned against Ada's shins and knees like they were the ladder to a chair back, watching the sun fall. The blue shadow of Jonah's Ridge advancing across the creek and in the pasture, barn swallows in jittery and reckless flight. Ada stroked Ruby's dark hair with an English-made brush of boar bristles. She worked until the hair was sleek and had the sheen of a new gun barrel. She ran her fingers through it, parting it into seven sections, and each cord had its own heft and resistance in her hands. She spaced them across Ruby's shoulders and studied them. Ada and Ruby were having a hair contest. It had been Ada's idea, suggested to her from watching Ruby absent-mindedly plait Ralph's tail in intricate patterns. Ruby would stand behind him, her thoughts elsewhere, eyes unfocused, fingers moving apparently without effort through the long tail hair. It seemed to assist in her thinking, and it would about put Ralph to sleep. He would stand with one hind hoof tipped and his eyelids flickering. Afterward, though, he went about with his hindquarters slightly tucked under him, nervous and embarrassed-looking, until one or the other of them went and undid his tail and brushed it out. Ruby seemed so enviably dreamy during the making of the plaits that Ada imagined her as a lonely and abandoned child wandering the countryside to braid the tails of old solitary plow horses out of need for proximity to something live and warm. To touch it in a way both intimate and distant, not to lay a hand directly to its life, but to the beautiful and bloodless extrusion of it. In such spirit, Ada had proposed they vie to see who could compose the most intricate or beautiful or outlandish plait of the other's hair. It would make the competition all the more interesting that neither would know what had been done with her own hair, only what she had done with the other's, until they went inside and stood with paired mirrors to examine the backs of their heads. The loser was to perform all the night work, while the winner rocked on the porch and watched the sky darken and counted the stars as they appeared. Ada's hair had already been finished. Ruby had worked for some time pulling and twisting until it was yanked back tight at Ada's temples. She could feel its pull at her eye corners. She started to pat the back of her head, but Ruby reached and slapped her hand away to prevent any foreknowledge as to how the competition stood. Ada took the three tresses at the center of Ruby's back and made a simple pigtail. That was the easy part. With the remaining pieces, she planned to build a complex overbraid, lapping and weaving in a herringbone pattern, like a favorite raffia basket of hers. She took up two of the side pieces and began lacing them up. Four crows, notch-wing in the lead, drifted down into the cove and then flared when they saw the new scarecrow. They flew away squealing like shot pigs. Ruby called it a favorable comment on Ada's construction. "That hat, in particular, is a fine touch," she said. "It came from France," Ada said. "France," Ruby said. "We've got hats here. A man up East Fork weaves straw hats and will swap them for butter and eggs. Hatter in town makes beaver and wool, but generally wants money." This business of carrying hats halfway around the world to sell made no sense to her. It marked a lack of seriousness in a person that they could think about such matters. There was not one thing in a place like France or New York or Charleston that Ruby wanted, and little she even needed that she couldn't make or grow or find on Cold Mountain. She held a deep distrust of travel, whether to Europe or anywhere else. Her view was that a world properly put together would yield inhabitants so suited to their lives in their assigned place that they would have neither need nor wish to travel. No stagecoach or railway or steamship would be required. All such vehicles would sit idle. Folks would, out of utter contentment, choose to stay home, since the failure to do so was patently the root of many ills, current and historic. In such a stable world as she envisioned, some might live many happy years, hearing the bay of a distant neighbor's dog, and yet never venture out far enough from their own fields to see whether the yawp was from hound or setter, plain or pied. Ada did not bother arguing, for she figured that her life was moving toward a place where travel and imported hats would figure small. The braid was finished, and she looked on it with disappointment. As with all her efforts toward art, it did not match up with her imagining of it. She thought it looked like a hemp lanyard twisted together by a mad or drunken sailor. Ada and Ruby stood up from the steps and took turns touching each other's braids to smooth down stray hairs and tuck in loose pieces. They went to Ada's bedroom and backed up to the large mirror over the commode table and took a silver hand mirror and paired up the images. Ada's plait was simple and tight, and when she put her fingers to it, she thought it felt like touching a chestnut limb. You could work all day and it would not spring loose. When it came Ruby's turn, she took a long time looking. She had never seen the back of her head before. She put her hand to her hair and touched it flat-palmed, patting it over and over. She declared it perfect and would hear of nothing but that Ada be judged victor. They went back to the porch, and Ruby went on into the yard, ready to get on with the night work. But she stopped and stood looking around and then up at the sky. She touched the hair at her neck and at the crown of her head. Out from under the shade of the porch, she could see that there was yet light enough to read a few pages from Midsummer Night's Dream, and she said as much. So they sat back on the steps and Ada read, glossing as she went, and when she got to a line of Robin's, where he says, "like horse, hound, hog, bear, fire," at every turn, Ruby was immensely amused and said the words over and over, as if they held a great deal of meaning and delight just in themselves. The light soon fell too gray to read. A pair of bobwhites called their identical three-word messages back and forth from the field to the woods. Ruby rose and said, "I better get on." "Check our trap," Ada said. "No point. You don't catch anything by day," Ruby said, before walking away. Ada closed the book and plucked a boxwood leaf as page marker. She took Inman's letter from her skirt pocket and tipped the face of it to the west to gather what light remained there. She had read the utterly vague announcement of his wound and his planned return 5 times that afternoon. She could make no more of it after the 5th reading than she had from the first, which was that Inman seemed to have reached some firm conclusion about the state of feeling existing between them, though Ada could not herself put a name to how she thought things stood. She had not seen him in almost 4 years, and it had been more than 4 months since she had last heard from him, just a brief dashed note from Petersburg, its tone impersonal as something one would write to a distant relation, though that was not unusual, for early on Inman had asked that they never speculate on what might happen between them after the war. Nobody could say how things would be then, and imagining the various possibilities, either pleasant or grim, only cast a shadow over his thoughts. Their correspondence through the war had been irregular, flurries of letters and then stretches of silence. This last stretch, though, was a long one even by their standards. The letter Ada now held was without date, nor did it contain any mention of recent events, or even weather by which it could be dated. It could have been written the week past, or it might be 3 months old. The letter's battered condition argued for a date nearer the latter, but there was no way to know. And she was unclear about his coming home. Did he mean now or at the end of the war? If he meant now, there was no telling whether he was long overdue to return or just setting out on his journey. Ada thought of the story she and Ruby had heard the captive tell from the barred window of the courthouse. She feared every county would have its Teague. She squinted at the paper. Inman's hand being somewhat cramped and minute, all Ada could make out in the dark was this brief paragraph. "Should you still possess the likeness I sent 4 years ago, I ask you please do not look at it. I currently bear it no resemblance in either form or spirit." Ada, of course, went immediately to her bedroom and lit a lamp and opened drawers until she found the portrait. She had put it away because she never thought it looked much like him to begin with. When it arrived, she showed it to Monroe, who held a dim view toward photography and had never been photographed and never intended to be, though he had twice in his younger years sat for painters. He had examined Inman's countenance with some interest and then snapped the case shut. He went to the shelves and pulled out a volume and read from Emerson on the experience of being daguerreotyped, saying these words, "And in your zeal not to blur the image, did you keep every finger in its place with such energy that your hands became clenched, as for fight or despair? And in your resolution to keep your face still, did you feel every moment more rigid, the brows contracting into a Tartarian frown, and the eyes fixed as they are fixed in a fit, in madness, or in death?" And though that was not precisely the effect of Inman's picture, Ada had been forced to admit that it was not far off the mark either, so she had put it away in order not to have her memory of Inman blurred by it. Such little mechanical portraits as Ada now held in her hand were not rare. She had seen any number of them. Nearly every family in the settlement with a son or husband off fighting had one, even if only cased in tin. Displayed on mantel or table, with the Bible, a taper, sprigs of galax, so that the effect was altar-like. In 61, any soldier with $1.75 could have his aspect recorded in the form of ambrotype, tintype, calotype, or daguerreotype. In those early days of war, Ada had found most of the ones she had seen comic. Later, she found them depressing in their depictions of men now dead. One after the other, they had sat bristling with weaponry before the portraitist for the long exposure. They held pistols crossed at their breasts or bayoneted rifles at their sides, shiny new Bowie knives brandished for the camera, forage caps set at swank angles on their heads, farm boys more bright in their moods than on hog-killing days. Their costumes were various. Men wore every kind of thing to fight in, from clothes you might put on for plowing to actual uniforms, to garbs of such immense ridiculousness that even in peacetime someone might take a shot at you for wearing them. Inman's portrait differed from most in that he had spent more money on the case than was usual. It was a beautiful little filigreed silver thing, and Ada rubbed it front and back against the skirt at her hip to polish away the dusty tarnish. She opened it and held it to the lamp. The image was like oil on water. She had to tip it in her hand, making fine adjustments to get the light to make sense of it. Inman's regiment had been casual about uniform. having agreed with their captain that nothing in the killing of Federals required an alteration of one's ordinary attire. In accordance with that belief, Inman wore a loosely constructed tweed jacket, a collarless shirt, and a soft slouch hat, the brim of which drooped to his brow.